All right, Michael, thanks so much for taking the time to join me today.
Sure, my pleasure.
So I'd love for us to start out and give the listeners a kind of short summary of your bio.
Sure. I'm a real anomaly in the investment banking world. I think I'm about 38 years of doing this, and most people are, you know, playing golf at my age or doing some other fun things. But I really like investment banking. So if anyone out there is looking for an exciting career that's stimulating, that every day is interesting, it just might not be a good day versus a bad day. Investment banking does it for me. So, yeah, my background, I was an undergraduate accounting major at George Washington University, and I never knew what accounting was until I went to college. Nobody in my family was even near that. And I was working on Capitol Hill, working for a U.S. senator, and school was just kind of something I did to get a degree, and then my senator lost. So I wanted to stay in the Hill, and I went to GW for an MBA, and he lost, and I went to work for Ernst & Young, and got my CPA there, and worked there for a couple of years. And this right around that time, investment banking, this is in the early 80s, was getting, was dormant for quite some time, and I thought I'd give it a try, and I married a woman from Philadelphia, and joined a firm called Butcher and Singer, which isn't around any longer. It's part of Wachovia, but we were the big Philadelphia investment bank. And back then, we were doing new issue business. There was no such thing as private equity. There was a couple of family offices and companies and families that needed liquidity went public. And I think there were 500-600 IPOs a year, and there was a whole infrastructure built on doing IPOs, and I'll get into that a little later why that changed. So I worked for Butcher and Singer, and like most companies, average 7-8 year. Well, Butcher and Singer's was a 100-year-old business, but we merged with a company called Wheat First out of Richmond, another major regional investment bank that's part of Wachovia today, or Wells Fargo, not Wachovia, and eventually decided to start my own firm. Being an entrepreneur, and youth and ignorance and money will come together and you start a firm. And we got institutional money, and we built a firm called Foley Moxon Howe that was bought by Johnny Montgomery Scott. After 2.5 years, we were the dominant underwriter in Philadelphia doing IPOs. Johnny bought us, and I went over to run Johnny Montgomery Scott. Great firm. It's in existence today, one of the larger regional firms out there. Actually, the individual running it today, Joe Cully, I hired him as an analyst at a Swarthmore College. So he's running capital markets there now.
Of large colleges. I'm a Williams alum, so I know well.
All right. Okay. Joe Cully did quite well. So after Johnny, I went to work for a big bank and realized that's not a place to do investment banking if you're entrepreneurial. And a couple of us who have worked together started up a firm called Moxon Howe Hunter, and we're 20 years in existence, and we really followed the migration of capital, which we could talk about, and we started a broker-dealer primarily to do sell-side M&A for multi-generational families. So that's what we do. Three-quarters of it is recaps with private equity, and our practice is, you know, national. But most of our companies tend to be east of the Mississippi.
Awesome. So thank you.
There's 22 of us. 22 of us, which in Philadelphia is a pretty good size M&A firm.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. I think in terms of just going back to your story, you know, coming out of George Washington, I'd love to hear like what it was like back then. You said, you know, there was, you know, investment banking and whatnot, but it wasn't maybe as established as it is today. Like it's just, you know, the firms are all smaller. Were you doing M&A? It says that you said issuances. So like, can you explain?
That's funny because a lot of people don't know that was the term. Yeah, new issuances, raising capital for public companies where you were an IPO is an initial public offering. And on what's your public, it was a secondary offering you would do.
Did you ever do any debt capital markets there or all? Was it all ECM? Pardon? Was it any debt capital markets, any leverage?
Yeah, back then, convertible debt was a big component of the capital markets where companies were able to raise a bond. It was typically a 15, 20 year amortization on these. Some were 10. And you were able to sell stock at 20 to 25% above the current market price. And it typically had a coupon on it, like 200 basis points below the treasuries back then. And I mean, the market's moved so rapidly today, you know, 20% above your stock price. But hedge funds started having a field day on, because they were able to hedge real well. They had on a convert, they had the underlying equity to hedge, and they had interest from the bond. So that kind of took care of the convert market. And I haven't seen a convert issued publicly in quite some time.
Yeah, for sure. So going back to your first kind of role out of your CPA, you're at Arthur Young, you're getting your CPA. Do you remember what your starting salary was?
$18,000. $18,000. $18,500, and that was kind of big time.
Yeah, that was like, you know, up in the top probably a couple percent, percent of.
Right, and then I joined investment banking. My salary became $30,000.
Yeah, and that was post MBA, right? That was post MBA at Butcher.
That was post MBA, and I was a couple of years out of Arthur Young. It was Arthur Young at the time. Now it's Ernst & Young. There were eight big accounting firms. Now there are four. We called them the Big Eight. It's a Big Four today.
Yep.
But in investment banking, I heard one of your podcasts. I just know what it would like, and you're telling the students start. It's better to start in a bad market and not get very good bonuses until later in life. And, you know, if you're good in investment banking, you're going to do well. And there are good years and bad years. And after, the risk reward is you have very little job security unless you're really good. But you're able to, I tell people, they pay you like an owner without putting up any equity. So,
yeah, no, it's true. Yeah, it can be outsized bonus. So you started at Butcher's.
Where did,
you started there in 81. You were there for a decade. Yeah. Right. And so
I was here for, I think, 14 years.
Oh, 14 years. Yeah. Okay. It says, so I'm just looking at your LinkedIn. So if I'm
then it became Wheat First, Butcher & Singer.
Got it.
I think I was there 12. Yeah.
And you became, you became head of investment banking there, correct?
Yeah. Like I don't think I was 30 when I became head of investment banking.
Can you talk to me? I mean, I think what would be curious to some of our audience, I'd be curious to hear about the progression. Is it similar to today? Like today, I know there's like the annual bonus in terms of like how you progressed that way. And then once you become like, is it VP where it's like they start becoming more of a sales role rather than just a process role? And can you talk about that transition? Was it really hard for
you? Sure.
Obviously, you eventually became head of investment banking, so you were doing something right. Can you talk a little bit about that transition internally at Butcher & Singer, and then how they started kind of rewarding you? So like they're not necessarily giving you equity, or are they giving you a percentage of your deals? How did that look?
No, it was the invisible hand, we call it. It was the gods above you who decided how much they had to pay you before you left.
Got it.
You know, and you get very good at negotiating bonuses after a while at an investment bank. But back in the early 80s, the capital markets were so primitive, and we would all kind of look at things where we can capture a market. And it's harder today to do that. If you're with a big firm, most of the business comes in through client relationships. If you're with an investment bank that has a commercial bank, you know, if you're sitting there with a couple of $1 billion of loans from Comcast, you issue to Comcast, Comcast is going to call you and you're going to be involved. They'll have three advisors on a deal and you'll be one of them. So there's a little bit of just the institutions able to bring in a lot of business. But back then, we would always look at what the hedge funds eventually became, where you look at anomalies in the market. And what propelled me to be head of investment banking, there were 400 back in the turn 83, the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, and every state had savings and loans, but states that had a lot of ethnic populations back when they came here, the banking system wasn't very open to new immigrants. So they started savings and loans associations, whether you were Ukrainian, whether you were Jewish, whether you were Polish. And throughout the Northeast, you had these mutuals. And banking still was a sole branch, or maybe you can have one contiguous county away. So it was still very cottage industry. So I looked and I saw, gee, there's 400 savings and loans in Pennsylvania, and they can raise capital right now. And I work for an investment bank brokerage firm that had the biggest branch in Pennsylvania. So I said, I'm going to learn how to convert these banks, these savings and loans to stock form, and we'll raise capital for them. And I got in my car, had a bunch of pitch books that we put together, and I went out to Hazleton and Wilkes-Barre,
You're
Scranton,
saying you went to all
Harrisburg.
these four, you're trying to basically go to all 400 of these.
Well, I went to the larger ones. Yeah, you
Larger
got it.
ones
But I
first.
probably had 50 out of 400. We went out and
But what's
spoke with.
the pitch? You're saying we could raise capital for you, help take some like money off the table.
Right, you can grow now. You sell or grow, and if you want to be a player, raise capital. We'll raise it in your community. We have a branch down the street, and we'll do these little offerings for you. And at that time, a lot of astute investors realized, because you were valuing them at book value, and you were raising cash at book value. Well, that pre-money valuation is half a book value, because whatever book was, you're raising cash after the deal. You just bought a bank at half the book value. So it was a no-brainer. And eventually the hedge funds came in, and people were calling our firm up to get shares in these new issues from the banks. And so somebody thought I was smart at Butch & Singer. It said, hey, kid, you're going to be head of investment banking right now. But your question, VPs ran deals, analysts supported it, and associates. We didn't compute, PCs weren't around yet. We were still using 16-page. And then there were
16
these
page, wait, you left me hanging. 16 page, what is this? What was it like?
16-page ledgers.
Ledgers.
They had ledgers, and you had whiteout, and you would turn around and give an assistant, a secretary, to type it up for you. And things worked at different speed.
This would have like
You can,
the income statement,
yes,
historical income statement.
income statement,
Gotcha.
balance sheet. You had to consolidate.
Yeah, so everyone listening complaining, imagine having to go reprint the books there or reprint
Well,
the ledgers.
but you had, these whiteouts, and you would put them on the machine, on the a copy machine. I mean, you had X-Acto knives that were cutting things out and putting
Wow.
it in. I mean, it was pretty elementary. But and then faxing came around, and then we could get faxes from the SEC. It was $1 a page, which was expensive. So to do a comp group, to get the latest Q, I mean, the analysts today and the bankers don't realize that they have Cap IQ and
Yeah, it's just all coming to them
similar.
their fingertips.
It clicks it. Well, today you need five people that 20 people did, back in the day. But that's how we had, from faxes, and then we moved on, and then we had intranets in the office where we can send files internally, and then the internet came, and life changed. So, but that's a little bit of how we got
So you were
how I
already
got
kind
there.
of you were maybe at VP level. You were already kind of doing the selling already, making business. So
Yeah, I was, but that was, there are certain people who have, I'm fortunate that I'm very technical, and I'm also have a marketing orientation. And that, so in the career in investment banking, you need to be intelligent and have really good skills. I mean, your modeling skills have to be tremendous, but you also have to have that sixth sense of, and I call it the art of the business, where the numbers give you support, but you have to have the confidence to say, it's a 70% probability we're going to go this direction. Let's do it. And there's a point in someone's career where you get that confidence. You have that frame of a reference from doing enough to say, yeah, this is what's going to happen. And people have to manage their careers. You just don't sit there and I'm there 3 years, and I have a and you need a mentor. You need to be smart. You have to have a mentor in the organization who wants to bring me along.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's hard
But
is when people, I mean, especially nowadays, you have students that are in their sophomore years expected to like know what investment banking is and be ready for technical questions. Even at liberal arts colleges now, like we go out and when we do this, you know, we do the academy, we're reaching out to freshmen now. We have to, because if they come sophomore year, it's too late. They've missed the window.
You know, I would never get a job in investment banking today. So
yeah, neither would I. No, I don't feel bad.
Were you an analyst somewhere?
I was an analyst at Rothschild for 2 years in New York, okay. Doing mostly restructuring work, and then did private equity for 4 years. So I experienced it, and then I did my MBA and ended up doing the entrepreneurial thing as well. Like,
good for you. Yeah. Well, I took my entrepreneurial spirit into investment banking, but it's harder today. It's a mature industry. Private equity and the hedge fund community really did take a lot of the opportunities that investment bankers had previously.
Can you elaborate on that? That's interesting to me. What do you mean by that specifically? Like,
because if you wanted to raise capital back in the late 80s, there weren't a lot of hedge funds. Private equity funds.
Yeah.
And if there were, they, you know, were doing leverage buyouts with 15-20% equity, and that. So investment banks are where you raise capital. So if you wanted to acquire a company, and you're a public company, you went to an investment bank,
yeah,
and you know, we sold equity or converts or some other or debt, yep, to fund a transaction. So we were the place to be, and that's where you raise capital. What happened around 2001? There was a regulatory problem, and that Congress was looking into favoritism on behalf of investment banks who were giving hot IPOs. And you have to remember, at that point in time, PCs and the internet were just starting, you know, PCs were maturing a little bit, and, you know, the internet was just taking hold. And there were so many IPOs, and they were, you know, doubling, tripling on day one, and they were going to preferred customers, and they weren't going to widows and orphans, the retail market. And Eliot Spitzer, who was the attorney general of fame in New York, put the kibosh on investment banks and put regulations in place that analysts couldn't talk to investment banking. Back in the day, I would never sell a deal if I didn't have a good analyst with me, but you can't do that anymore. And so what happened, all that infrastructure left, and private equity, risk capital, started going into private equity. Private equity became much larger than what investment banks were underwriting.
Yep, I can hear you.
I just got a call, so I just got And so that was the beginning of the growth of private equity. And as an investment banker, the decimalization took place, so you couldn't make money in trading. In 1997, we were getting 27 cents a share.
Amazing. Right?
That's on average. Today, you're not even getting a penny.
Yeah.
So, you know, you can't trade. So we pivoted groups like ours to doing M&A for private equity and strategic. And that it was a whole different skill set. And a lot of the fundamentals are the same. But, you know, analysts still needed to do comp groups and good modeling and DCFs, and LBO models became popular. And that's kind of where we pivoted. And today, private equity is now a mature industry.
Yes.
And it's just harder to find. Very few private equity firms will have any proprietary deal flow. It's all coming out of investment banking.
They all say they do.
I haven't heard of it. Yeah. They all say they do, right?
Yeah.
They tell their LPs when they're raising money, proprietary deal flow, right? But
So going back to your time, you know, Butcher and Singer, you said around 14 years. You're progressing there, as you're moving up to head of investment banking there, what was the impetus to suddenly say, you know what, I'm going to go start my own investment bank? Was it because of falling out with the other partners or other head? You know, you were head, right? So
I was head, yeah.
I assume the owners, then you were negotiating every year for bonuses. You're bringing in more business to them, and you're thinking to yourself, why am I bringing in all this business to them? And eventually, like, why don't I just do this myself after 12, 14 years? Or how did that build the decision?
When, you know, today you join an industry group, And after 14 years of doing investment banking, I did a lot of industries, and then I got head of the firm. So my relationships were not industry specific any longer. Mm-hmm. They were Comcast was one of my first clients I started with. So you get investment banking is relationship driven once you get senior. You could be the best investment banker, but if you don't have a relationship with that partner at the PE fund or at Comcast or whatever corporation, you're not always going to get the business. So we call it the last whisper in the ear. You do pitches, you can be the best, but you're not always going to win. So what the new firm that merged with us wanted to put me into an industry group, and I just felt, I've moved on from that.
Yeah.
And I was kind of a little kingmaker. So I said, I got to start my own firm. Yeah. And we did that, a group of us, and we got institutional backing, built it up, and then sold it.
And that's when Janny came in, said, hey, you guys are doing good business.
Right. And you're doing some good stuff.
And so you were at Janny for a few years. Then you
about said, 8-9 years.
8-9 years. And then you basically at that point, was there any point at this, you're making probably pretty good money at this stage, is there any point at this stage, you're out of it, head of investment banking, where you're saying, you know what, I'm going to hang it up, maybe just a few more years, or you were just enjoying it too much?
I enjoy it too much. I think.
And tell me about your hours. Tell me about your hours too. Like, were you feeling burnt out, or was it more reasonable?
Much more reasonable outside of New York. And the listeners here, New York is just a grind. It's more physical than intellectual, I think.
Yeah.
And if you leave New York, you're still going to have, crazy hours, but there's a quality of life. So I moved to Philadelphia. I had a home in Center City. I walked to work. There was no internet back then, so you couldn't, you had to go to the office to get your work. So I go home, I have kids, I have dinner, I come back. Was I making New York money? No. Was I making good money for Philadelphia? Absolutely. But it was really more, I just liked the pace, the action, the intellectual part of it, being a psychologist with clients. I mean, it just had, for someone like it's a lot of activity. I think investment banking is great. It can be exhausting at times, but outside of New York, you can get a quality of life. And, you're not doing, if you're an analyst or an associate, three quarters of your 14-hour day isn't doing pitches for an analyst or a partner to go, make a pitch that he's not going to win. It's more deal-related.
Can you talk to me about that, how that progressed, even just at Butcher and Singer before you left and did your own thing in terms of your hours? Was it like 60-ish a week, 70 a week when you were younger, and then it kind of gradually?
It was probably, good 10, 12-hour days consistently, a weekend day. Occasionally you pulled. Back then, you had all-nighters when you were taking companies public and you went to the printers. You had to put a prospectus together and you had to read it as it came off the press before you could distribute them. So, it's, if somebody works 12 hours, that's a good day. For 5 days, that's a good estimate.
Yeah, and then I was going to ask you just in terms of the type of work you're doing. So you mentioned something about pitching and not, going and it, leading to nothing. At Butcher and Singer, it was a pretty big firm at the time. It's not like it was a small upshot. So was the name really strong in the sense of you guys were for the most of the time doing actual live deal work, or was there a period?
It was mostly live deal work. You would, because when you underwrote a stock, when you took a company public, it's called underwriting.
Yeah.
And you were an underwriter and you had a tie to that company because you were the market maker. You were the key market maker in their stock. So they knew that relationship was important and they would keep you, and you knew who the institutional buyers were. And you had street name accounts that voted. There was a natural relationship to stay close to your underwriter. And so Butcher had accounts coming back for new business. M&A, consulting. So, but most of the time, our people are, it's 25% pitching, three quarters of the time working on live deals.
Okay.
I think that's probably what a lot of the
I'd be curious
non-New York boutiques.
Let's fast forward to kind of you going a little bit. So then, Jenny, you're there for a while. Jenny, after the acquisition, and then you ended up going, I see Commerce Capital Markets for 3.5. Is that?
Yeah.
Right?
So
talk about just quickly like there, what happened there? And then before you, I'm going to start my own firm.
That's a great story. So Vernon Hill, who, if you do FIG work, built Commerce Bank. I started working with him in 1983. It was maybe 80, 90 million in total assets, which is a small branch today for a bank. And so we started doing underwritings for him. Banks always need capital. So back then, New Jersey was, growing exponentially. And he, a brilliant, brilliant guy who used to own McDonald's franchises, said, I'm going to be like, he called them stores. And they ended up growing the bank, certainly the largest bank in Philadelphia. So I stayed with him for 20 years, did all his M&A, did all his underwriting. So when it got to a certain point in Chatty where there was a change of management, and like any career, you have to look around and say, do I pivot here and go somewhere else? And I decided to do that. There's something great about just staying somewhere forever if you can, but organizations change, cultures change. And I thought it was time to leave. And Vernon Hill said to me, Mopson, build me an investment bank. And I said, okay. So we built it up. This is right before 9/11. We took it up to about 50 people. We were in San Francisco, New York, Philadelphia, Chicago, Boston.
Wow.
Institutional offices. We had a sales and trading operation. We had analysts. And then 9/11 came, Elliott Spitzer came. The regulators were really looking at investment banks. And I think there was a little too much for a commercial bank at that time to want to take on. So I decided it wasn't a good fit. And I decided to start up my own firm to just do what with the kind of people that I'd like to hire. And we're going to do sell side M&A. And so we started a broker dealer. Today, we're 21, 22 people. We have Philadelphia and DC. And we're just very focused on sell side M&A.
Great. And I'd love to hear just a little bit now going to Mopson. Obviously your namesake. Going and talking a little bit about that was in 2004. I'm trying to remember back.
Yeah.
Things have started recovering at that point, right?
So
it's a little bit but I'd love to hear just how the firm dealt with, the great financial crisis, 2008-09, and how things where were you at the point of 2007, 2007, it had been 3 years you had founded, at what stage were you? And then how did you kind of navigate that? And then how have you seen the last 10, 10 years or so?
Yeah. Well, you realize that the very low barriers to entry in investment banking, in particular M&A. So, and every time I go to ACG events, which is the M&A Association, the Association for Corporate Growth, and I look over the speed dating we do, and there must be 100 investment banks and 100 PE firms that are having 20-minute meetings, and you realize there are a lot of us out there. So even though people knew who we were, we didn't have a track record, and we slowly had to build it. And you realize once you rip off an institutional brand from who you are, and now it's you, it took the market a while to get comfortable with us. So we were just starting to get going, and the financial crisis of 2007 came. And it, put us on hold for quite some time. So, but we were also
How big were you at that point? Like a small, small group?
We were maybe 10, 11 of us. So it wasn't, so, and, we kept putting money in the firm to keep it going. And Really around 2009, 2010, it started picking up again. And
Was it
it's been
like
very
zero
innovative.
deal? Were there like zero deals in 08 or like two deals?
We started doing valuations. That's how hard up we were. Where people would pay us $25,000 for a valuation, some a little more. We were trying to do fairness opinions. It was much more consultative type work, but you try to do whatever you can. Buy side M&A work, which we don't do,
To
it's
survive,
really
yeah,
hard to,
to not have to let
you do
negotiate.
what you have to survive. You realize your survival instincts, but so the firm wasn't killing it back then. But then, every year it got, very iterative, and you do more and more deals in the space. As we say, we print tickets. And but we were, hiring analysts that we have a 2-3 year analyst program that we can talk about and how that differs from the big firms. We hung in there, and having done this long enough, every downtick, you come up stronger. I don't know why. It's a natural law. If you can hang through, you just get, a little, oh, they made it. Okay, they made it. And so today, I think we have a brand in the marketplace. We tell people who come to work for us, it's a very flat organization. We don't have a lot of hierarchy. We treat an analyst like we do an MD, a managing director. Everyone is treated with respect, and it's a nice culture.
That's great. And what's you said? I think at the top of the podcast, you have about 20. Your team is about 20.
Yeah, 20, 22. Yeah.
And most of it's sell side M&A and or like with private
Yeah.
equity doing recaps. Can you talk to the audience, the ones that aren't familiar with like recapitalization? What does that even mean? Like, how would a bank advise a PE fund on that?
So we wouldn't have, we don't advise to PE funds. But we'll take on a sell side engagement. And what that means is you're a private company. We come in and we do due diligence. We tell you what we think the market is going to pay for you. We work with a quality of earnings firm, even though they might have an audit. Many of the companies don't. They have reviewed financials. Quality of earnings has become de rigueur of if you don't know what a quality of earnings is, it's an accounting firm goes from GAAP to cash flow. So you and many times we have add backs in our analysis. We determine EBITDA for a private company. Then we put a confidential information memorandum together, and then we do an auction, which is international today. Which is, when I started in the business, we went out to 10, 15 buyers. Today, it's 150, 180. And it's all over the world, basically. And over a SIM, with a quality of earnings, you get people to bid. And there's a whole process you do. But private equity, a recap is typically family business. In 2022, we sold three 100-plus-year-old businesses. I mean, and so that's pretty heavy stuff for the family, typically. But a recap is private equity will buy 70%, 80% of the business. The family rolls over 20, and then they go out as a platform, and they go out and do tuck-ins and buy other businesses, and then they sell it again. So we're dealing with mostly lower middle market company, private equity, and our guys sell it to the next step up in the private equity world. That are, if we sell them the $1 billion AUM private equity firms, they're selling to $7 to $8 billion AUMs, and then they eventually work their way up to Apollo, KKR, and that ilk. So that's the pecking order.
That's great. And so, if listeners want to actually apply to become analysts or associates or even VPs at your firm, what's the best place? Just go to your website and submit an application
Go to
there.
our website. I mean,
Or
if we hire,
should they harass you on LinkedIn or?
we're a nice group. We hire, anywhere from one to four a year, depending on the circumstances. So that's the issue. You go to a JP Morgan, they're hiring hundreds. And so you need a lot of little, smaller firms like ours. We tend to like to hire people who are local, that have a reason to be in Philadelphia. you know, they might have grown up here or they went to college here. Mm-hmm. And we don't put them through the kind of rigors that the large firms do. But what we look for is someone who has the verve to be an investment banking. When you ask them, have you taken any classes to prep? Oh, yes, on the side, I take classes. Oh, really? Great. Do you do this? Yeah. You know people who, there's a whole methodology. You talk about it in your podcast of getting a job. So, you know, you need to know the rules of the game to play it well.
Do you have
somebody coming in?
Sorry, I was just going to ask about the intern. Do you have an intern program, the formal intern program from that 1 or 4? Is like, you know, a couple interns a summer?
You know, every summer, you know, we have 2 this summer. Mm-hmm. And it was slow. And people ought to know it's a lot of work to have interns. They have to be managed. You need to make it interesting for them because that's, you want them to feel good about the firm. So when we have interns, it's like a burden to management. And the people out there ought to know. And we don't do volunteer interns, so we pay them so they feel like, you know, they're it's the real deal. It's selective, but it's not always on merit. You know, a lot of it has to do with, as we say, who came in with what fingerprints on them. And now, you know, it could be an ex-client, it could be somebody who is influential, but the consistency, they have to be very high GPA. They need to really want to be an investment banker and know they want to be an investment banker and have done the right kind of things to get prepped for it. And we get a lot of inbound emails from people. That's hard. And occasionally I will write someone, thank you, we don't have any openings, but I'm a rarity. Most people just don't hear. But I'm blown away by the resumes I read from rising juniors, rising sophomores. I even just got someone from a local high school, Joanna Wharton, and he wrote me an email. He's in high school. And he told me, you know, I'm prepping at the divs. So it is so competitive out there.
Yeah.
And the days have just gotten my dad knows somebody and I'm going to walk into an investment bank. It just, you know, it's too Darwinian today. You can't, you've got
to see the same
be the real deal.
Yeah, we see the same thing. We have we actually have somebody from that's incoming Wharton freshman who's already in the academy who wants his goal straight to the buy side private equity. So not an easy goal, but you know he's already in. He's already prepping before his freshman year. I mean, he hasn't even graduated high school.
I know.
So it just
it might be the same
you.
Person. Yeah.
Yeah.
So same
person, exactly.
And that probably wasn't when you were starting.
No, I didn't even know. I didn't have a junior internship, and I still made it. I still got in. Nowadays, that's incredibly difficult, especially in a weaker kind of deal environment right now. There's, you know, historically it was it tends to be around 90% of the interns get full-time offers. Now it dropped to about 70%, 75% last summer. And so you have, if you think about it, well, what happens to those, you know, thousands of kids around the country that had the internships from the Evercores, from the Goldmans, from the cities, they're all flowing. They still want to potentially do banking, right? You know, they to see it as a good career. So they tend to go down to the middle markets, lower middle markets, boutiques. And so you have this huge influx of pretty incredible talent kind of flowing downstream to the smaller banks right now. So I would not be shocked if you had like top candidates, banging down your door right now.
We do. Yeah. And so, but if you're from the area, you have reason to be there. What we try to avoid is hiring people who we know just want the experience on the resume and will not be able to hire them. And so when candidates come in, they might want to emphasize why us. Like, you're in San Francisco, you're at Berkeley, I see nothing on your resume that says you have any East Coast anything.
Yeah.
It's just not going to happen. Yeah. But there are a slew of good investment banks like ours that hire summer interns. And everyone wants to go directly to private equity. I think as an analyst, you're going to do better at an investment bank. You're going to learn broader skills. You're going to see more activity. Not that I mean, it's great to go directly to private equity, but I think your skill sets are going to be well honed. Like you got to your career. You walked into a private equity firm, you sat down and you didn't use a mouse. You could do Excel right off the keyboard. Am I right?
Correct.
Pretty much?
Yep. Yep.
I love that.
It's like playing a musical instrument. I never got as good at as the associate that was above me. He was very. Yeah. It was scary to watch him. How fast?
I know. You would see steam coming off the keyboard.
Yeah.
But you know, you got that because you did so much of that in as an analyst. So, but you know, going direct is great. You know, hedge fund community. I can't address too much because I don't. Most of their skill sets, they like investment bankers.
There's an argument. Yeah, I think I said this in another podcast. I haven't done one of these like career mapping ones in a while, but there's an argument to be made, I think, that the pendulum has swung too far in terms of like private equity is the end all be all, where there's so much hopping right now that for the person who joins banking, it actually just becomes a career banker and loves it and is good with clients and sticks around. They're going to get an associate promote almost within like guarantee within 2 years if they're good. Like much higher pay. So like, actually, if you're looking to like, you know, staying where you are, where you're well known, where the deal volume is good, but like the life, you know, the work life balance isn't like a complete sweatshop, it's actually a pretty compelling place to be versus like going to potentially a very, you know, lower middle market PE fund that's maybe on their first fund. You don't know how their second fund is going to go. It's not as if, you know, all is, you know, roses in the PE world either in terms of like the vintage, the returns that are coming out. I got let go within 3 months of my first PE gig. The fund kind of went like this. So, I mean, it's not the safest, not that banking is the safest place either, but it's not as if private equity is the safest either. So,
Well, I think culture is so important in a private equity firm. Investment banks have reputations and it needs to be a culture that is nurturing, at least I believe, because you really need to get the best out of people. And people can't be worrying about job security every day they come in.
Yeah.
And so that is how we do it. And we go out to pitches, people see we look very different, but there's a thread running through it. Everyone is, you know, intelligent, articulate, they're rounded elbows, and we do what's right for the client. Private equity, there's, I don't know, 5,000, 7,000, these numbers all over the place. But in middle market, there's probably a good 500, of which 250 we have pretty active relationships with. Each one of them is quirky, and, you know, some, and we meet with them, and it's like, you know,
totally
these people are, it's a brand, you know, we're all brands today. You know, PE Fund One has to have a brand, and they come to these pitches. And it's like, why would I ever want your money? You're like, you're awful, you know? And other firms come in to sell our clients. So, you know, it's students that are looking for jobs. As much as they want a job, is picking the right group. And I think there's a lot, family outside of New York, San Francisco, Chicago, of smaller PE and investment banks.
For sure. Well, Michael, before we call it, any last words of wisdom for looking back on your career and guidance? I mean, obviously very entrepreneurial, actually, even though you've been in banking for such a long time, but like curious, you know, what you think if you'd advise that something similar for these people or something else?
You know, today it's, there's for those who can't get into investment banking because it's such a cyclical industry and we pendulum swing. When the markets get bad, we just lay off too many people. When the markets are good, we hire too many people. And so, but there are a lot of avenues. I think starting out, if you can't get into investment banking, I think doing transactional work at the accounting firms is excellent because doing quality of earnings work and due diligence, you really get a tremendous insight that investment banks will want after 2 years or 3 years there, and private equity also. So looking on the periphery, knowing little firms like ours hire, you know, 2-3 people a year, you got to contact a lot of people and you have to work networks. But I would say to people, if they want to do it, find a way to get in and just stay with it and you'll eventually prevail. But you need to be prepared because the market is so intense. There's so many people that want to do it, and they're doing extracurricular activity outside of college. We hired an analyst from Northwestern. They were offering classes for analysts there, and he took third-party classes. And you walk into an interview, like, you see the effort that he made. It's like, hey, this kid's for us, you know. So prepare. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's true. I think it is that the bar is so much higher than when either one of us were kind of going into the industry. And I think it's probably because of the function of a little bit of the glamorization of the PE, the buy side world, where people are like, oh, banking is that exit op, is it allows me for those exit opportunities. So I need to, you know, my first step is investment banking to, you know, that glamorized life. So I think I'd ask the listeners to kind of think of two things. Number one, what you said in terms of like, yeah, it's very competitive. You got to make sure you want to do it, number one. But number two, think about like, do you actually want to stay in this long run? Because if you do, the pendulum is swung so far and everyone's saying, oh, I want to get out, I want to go to this. There's actually probably a lot of opportunity of just staying where you are and, you know, going up the ranks that way.
So looking back on my 35, 38 years of doing this, I have to do a little arithmetic.
Yeah.
You know, friends of mine who stayed in one place, it worked out pretty well.
Yeah.
I don't think there's a right or wrong, but the adage of the grass is always greener, you know, it appears it's better somewhere else and you leave and you realize it's no different from when you left.
Yeah.
But there's something about, you know, loyalty and longevity and tenure at an organization means a lot. So, I mean, there are people in my firm who have been with me since the beginning, and there's, you know, changing, that's one of those life decisions you have to make, and you look back after your career and decide whether they were good or bad, and luck has a lot to do with it too. So,
well, I think we'll leave it there, Michael. I appreciate you taking so much out of your day to share your wisdom and your story. And
I think what you're doing is great. You know, to have a resource for young people who, you know, a lot of
appreciate
kids
that.
Don't have opportunities to know about investment banking unless their dads or moms were involved.
That's
with
the
it.
Goal. Get them more knowledge out there, so more people from all backgrounds can kind of figure it.
You're the son of a school teacher. You're not going to know this kind of stuff. So, so it's great to have your resource. Good luck. And anytime. I enjoyed it. Thank you.
Same to you.